God calls each one of us into ministry. I'm not saying full-time ministry, full-time preaching. I'm saying he calls us to a ministry that he sees that we are able to do. And in his power, he can expand that ministry 1,000-fold. I stand as a living witness to you today. I was a kid. We lived in North Vancouver. I had this big motorcycle. You know, that was my big deal. At that time, and I would go to my, you know, go to Argyle Secondary High, and my big motorcycle, you know, vroom, 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 vroom. And everybody looked at me, where did this guy get that bike, you know, brand new bike, and stuff like that. And I mean, it was, my world was different when I was like 17, 18, like even 19. I wasn't thinking about ministry. I wasn't thinking about, you know, what God wanted in my life. I mean, it was there, but it wasn't really something that I really, it wasn't my heartbeat at that time. But, you know, God had called me already way in my youth now. I'm not sure how many people here would remember by a man by the name of David Wilkerson. Would you, anybody? Anybody? Somebody? Might? Yeah. Yeah. Like Nikki Cruz, you know, Run Baby Run, Crossing the Switchblade, David Wilkerson. He came to Vancouver when I was about 15 years of age. We were at the Pacific Coliseum was the name of that place. We were there. There's about 5,000 young people in that auditorium. And he preached that night, and he said, you know, God has a purpose for you young people. And he said, God is calling many young people here to dedicate their lives fully to God. And I'm going to call you guys forward, those of you who feel the call of God in this particular service, come forward, and I want to just pray for you and bless you. And he said, but those of you who don't want to make a 100% commitment to God, don't come. If you want to make 25% commitment to him, don't come. He doesn't need 25%. And he said, if you want to give 50, not a bargain. God doesn't want his 50%. He wants, when he calls you, he wants 100%. And he's talking about a relationship. My heart, God's heart, 100%. The details about what you're going to do in life is God's business. He'll lead you. Anyway, what happened was when I left this church when I was at the age of 20, I went back to Finland, to my home, the country of my birth, you know, after spending 20 years almost on this continent. I had no idea what God would do. I had no idea what God was about to do. And one of the things that kind of like surprised me was that I went to the Soviet Union. I got married to an underground believer, a Christian, a young lady by the name of Laura. And if you want to know how that happened, I'll just give you a bit of a background. But before I do that, John, I mean, how many books do we have, Only Believe? Do we have maybe 20, 30 books?
In the car now.
No, but I mean, here? Yeah. I want to promise you something. Each one of you people, next service, next time you come together, if John, you could make available a book called Only Believe. It's a love story, it's a spy story, and it's a story, most of all, of God's great miracles in our lives as we have seen. So if you haven't read the book, it's worth the read. It's a good, easy read, and it'll keep you interested all the way through because of what God does. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of a background there. When I went to the Soviet Union, I just went to meet underground Christians way back. That was in the 70s. When I went to an underground service, which means like, you know, underground services mean there's a persecuted church and you can't, you know, freely, meet in places. So you're underground. You're below the radar. So I was in one of those meetings. And because I came from the West to Russia, they asked me, you know, with a couple of other guys, just say a word of greeting, you know, from the West to us Eastern Christians, you know, it'd be nice. And I did. And my translator happened to be Laura. And didn't know she was going to be my wife, but I didn't know she was going to translate for me. I just stood up and I started to say a few words and I looked at her. That was it. Love at first sight. I was like 22 years of age, right? I mean, like, you know, 21. So anyway, I got to know her. There was no such thing as dating. I mean, you get a visa for 3 days to enter the Soviet Union. Visa expires, you're out of there. There's no such thing as dating. Besides, it was kind of like, it would have been funny dating anyway because the church is persecuted and you want to date. Everybody was concerned about something else. Anyway, so we got married, And when I got married, I never thought that my marriage would be like, you know, worth it. I mean, worth all the commotion, all the interest. The intelligence agencies of three countries got involved in our marriage. Can you believe it? One of them was RCMP, intelligence. I came home 1 month before I got married in the Soviet Union to get my documents that the Soviet authorities needed for me to get married. I come to my mom's house in North Vancouver, and I'm home for 24 hours. I just arrived, and the phone rings. And mom gives me the phone, and this is the RCMP. Welcome home. How did they know? How did they know I'm home? Welcome home. Can we come and visit you tomorrow? You don't say no to them. You don't say no. So they came. And, you know, when they came to the door, it wasn't like, you know, hi, how you doing, sunny day. They pulled out their badges, RCMP intelligence. And I didn't even know he had an intelligence department at that time. I thought the FBI took care of it on the U.S. side. So, I mean, I was shocked. I go, what's going on here? And they talked to me for 4 hours. And they said, we just want to know what's happening. You've been there. You've been to the Soviet Union 27 times. I said, how do they know that? How do they know that? Yeah, and it's true. I had been to the Soviet Union 27 times. And he said, well, we just want to know how things are going. Have you ever been pressured to undersign documents to cooperate with the KGB? You know, and stuff like this. And I said, tell us about your trip. So I did. And I told them times that I had been arrested. And I told them about my wife. Wife-to-be, Laura. She had been expelled from university. She was in her third year of medical studies in the Soviet Union, and she, in the process of preparing for the final exam that year, she came to know Jesus. And that's a story by itself. It's in the book, so I won't tell you about it, but you got to read it. She was the only student in her university that had ever come to know Jesus. And when she had that experience, she went to talk to the dean of the university and to her professor. I said, I can master the exam. I know all the stuff on atheism. I know all what the I've mastered the textbooks. I know everything. But when it comes to the last question on the exam, and every Soviet student had to answer that question, does God exist or does he not? My wife, not my wife at that time, she told the professor and then the dean of the university, I can take the exam and answer every single question. But when it comes to the last one, I have to admit, I do believe that God exists. And it was like a bomb had gone off at the university. It was like a bomb had gone off at the university. And I won't go into detail, but that's when persecution starts in a country like the Soviet Union. And there are other countries like that in the world today, the Islamic world, talking about, you know, even India nowadays, China. So when she told the dean of the university, because they called her in for interview, she said, what's going on? I mean, you know, there's commotion going on at the university. There's a disturbance. What's going on? Tell us. And so she told the dean. The dean, when the dean heard that she had come to know that God exists, he looked at her for about a half a minute in silence. And he said, you are the first person in all of my career that has come up to me and said, I believe in God. He said, I'm going to give you one piece of advice. Shut up and don't ever tell a single living soul what you just told me. About, you know, how you know came to know Jesus. Don't ever tell anybody at this university what you just said. And it'll be fine for you. You'll become an eye surgeon just like you want. It'll be okay. The problem was Laura was the center of attraction. She's a very social person. You know, she's like, she's the draw of the crowd. You know, what do you call that in English? You know, when you're the person in the crowd, she was that person. And so when she came to her friends, they looked at her and says, hey, what's happened to you? You look so different. I mean, what's in your expression? I mean, tell us what's going on. And so she told them about Jesus. Too late. She was expelled. And so the rest is in the book. But anyway, so we get married. The intelligence agent said, you know, at the end of the interview, having heard all this, they go, what's going to happen? Your wife actually cannot come out of the Soviet Union. We know that. And what if she can't? What's going to happen? Are you going to move to the Soviet Union? You're a Canadian citizen. I said, yeah, it's probably the scenario. I mean, if she doesn't come out, I got to go in. And they said, well, don't worry. If you ever have a problem, give us a call. We'll help you get her out of the Soviet Union. And for you, that don't doesn't mean much. But for me, I said, hey, how does that happen? This is the Iron Curtain. You don't get people out of the Soviet Union. It doesn't happen. How could Canadian intelligence promise that? Anyway, they never even bothered to ask. And then about 4 weeks later, I get a call. And they gave me the business card, but they never needed it. I get a call and they say, hey, by the way, it was great to talk to you. We're confident that, you know, you're able to handle yourself in the Soviet Union very well, even under pressure, even under interrogation and stuff like that. We want to make a proposition to you. We'd like to actually ask you if you would consider a life as a Canadian diplomat. We're going to offer you, we'd like to put you into training if you so wish to accept the offer. Put you into training for 2 years and we will train you to become a Canadian diplomat. We will place you in the Canadian embassy in Paris. That will be your station. You will have a great salary. You'll have the benefits. It'll be a great life. And they said, please consider. And I said to them, the calling of my life, the purpose of my life is kind of different. By that time, I already knew that I would be a missionary. I said, I can't do that. Can't do that. And so they said, well, if you ever do, give us a call. And there was another thing that happened in Vancouver, also in Canada, before I left. And that was, I studied at Argyle Secondary High School. I was part of the wrestling team. Wrestled, you know, not much today, but I was in better shape then. And I won the silver medal in the British Columbia Championships in my weight class. Simon Fraser University, and also other universities, they have their scouts, you know, they go out scouting for talent, hockey, you know, whatever, and including wrestling. So the Simon Fraser University scouts, they were doing their rounds, and they came to Argyle Secondary High School, and they saw me wrestle. I think it was there, or they might have seen me at a tournament. And they came up to my coach, Mr. Howes, at Argyle Secondary High, and they said to him, we're from Simon Fraser, and we noticed Hannu Hauka. He's probably a guy that we might want on our wrestling team at the university. And so Mr. Howes comes out to me one day and he says, Hannu, you've been spotted. And Simon Fraser University has offered you a scholarship to study for free at Simon Fraser University, all expenses paid. Just say yes. And he thought I would. Mr. Howes, my wrestling coach, thought I would. And I looked at him, but I was already feeling the call in my life of God. I had been to a short-term Bible school just before that. I said to Mr. Howes, Mr. Howes, it's a beautiful offer, but I can't accept it because the purpose of my life, I sense, is going to be different. I don't think I want to do that. And he was silent for a long time. He looked at me. He looked at me as I was strange. He looked at me and he goes, Hannu, you can't do that. You are the only guy in the history of Argyle Secondary High School who has ever been offered a scholarship, and you're saying, no, you can't do that. But I talked with him a bit, and I said, Mr. Howes, you know, I understand it's great, but I can't. There's another purpose for my life. And then he finally said, Hannu, I understand, but it's still incredible that you're going to deny this. Anyway, that kind of stuff. I came out of that background. I was here on this continent. I lived here. This is a part of my church. This church was my church. But I never knew. I could never expect and even guess what God had in store for me as in a life of missions. So after we got married in the Soviet Union, never heard from the Canadian intelligence after that. But at the same time, my wife was contacted by the KGB in the Soviet Union because they knew that there was going to be a marriage. And they knew that, my wife at that time, she was in the Soviet Union, she was a troublemaker because she was active in the underground church. She was a link between the West. She understood two languages, so she was a kind of like a translator between Western Christians, Eastern Christians in Russia. And she had, by the time I had like known her for about a year with these short little visas going in and out, she was ready to be shipped off to prison camp for 5 years, hard labor, because of her faith. And so when they found out that there's something going on between me and Laura, this Canadian guy and Laura and the Soviet Union, they figured we're going to easily just get rid of her, I guess let the marriage happen and she'll leave and it'll be problem solved. Anyway, it didn't quite happen like that. I mean, that happened, but it didn't happen the way they thought it would. So when we left, we got involved in a radio, a Christian radio ministry, which was broadcasting Christian radio programs over 11 superpower stations to the Soviet Union constantly. And when we got married, 2 days later, in Laura's home, we'd get this knock on the door, and I had forewarning that this would happen. Here comes a KGB colonel, high-ranking officer in Soviet state security, and he says, "We got to talk." And then he goes, he says, "We've been, you know, well, we talked a little bit about, you know, just, you know, got married, you know, how's life, you know, what do you want to do, and stuff like that." But then came the question. They said, "Have you ever met a Canadian intelligence officer?" For the first time in my life, I had met somebody a month earlier in Canada, and I never even knew that there was an intelligence agency. Now he is suddenly saying, this officer is saying, "Have you ever met an intelligence officer?" And I said, "Good grief, we're on Soviet territory, and I'm supposed to say, what am I supposed to say? I can't lie." I said, "Jesus, what do I say to this guy?" And so then I said, I heard the Holy Spirit say, "Just tell him the truth." So I said, "Okay, well, yeah, I did, actually, a month earlier. I met Canadian intelligence." "Oh, what did they say?" "Well, they said, if you ever have a problem getting your wife out of this country, they're going to help me." I go, "No, you don't have to worry about that. There's not going to be a problem. Just take it easy. No problem. Everything's going to be okay." And it was. No, they let her out and so on. But when we left the Soviet Union, we had one final meeting with the KGB. And what they told Laura was something I'll never forget. It's in the book. They said, "When you leave this country..." And the Soviets were very sensitive about, you know, their fame, well, about how people looked at the Soviet Union, their fame, whatever you call it, reputation. And they said "You'll have a guardian angel," to Laura. "You'll have a guardian angel behind you wherever you go after you leave this country. But remember that if there is a need, that guardian angel will turn into a demon and we will find you wherever you are on this planet. Have a great trip. Bon voyage." And I go, "Oof," you know. So, I mean, you know, you get the flavor of it all. I mean, God was calling me into a life and into a way of life that I had never seen or even dreamt of before, that he had planned. But God had a plan, a bigger plan. It wasn't just intelligence agencies, and it wasn't like, you know, these guys, spies and stuff like that. He had a plan for ministry. He wanted me for my own little life. He wanted to use me for his own purposes, which I, you know, kind of like unfolded over the years. But, you know, I'm reminded of a scripture. I think Paul talks about this. I think it's in Romans. Pastor Tupuran, you can correct me if I'm wrong. He says, that which was nothing in this world, which was like forsaken in English, what do they say? It's for nothing, like, you know, of no value, you know, looked upon, you know, like... Yeah, stuff like that. Paul talks about that. He says, God chose these and this for his own purposes, to confound the wise and to bring to naught that which is something. I'm the son of a fisherman. My dad was a fisherman on the West Coast over here. I was nothing. Still am nothing. But he chose even this little vessel for his own purposes. And God somehow seems to get enjoyment out of that. It seems to be pleasing to God to choose people who think or don't think of themselves as a whole lot, or think that there's no plan, think that God could never have a plan for me. He does. And he chooses you, and he starts to lead you down the pathway of his will to bring a lot of people into the kingdom of God, to let people know who Jesus is, so that they would be saved, sometimes small groups, sometimes individuals, sometimes masses. We've seen masses come to Jesus. I see that there are people here, you know, like from different ethnic groups. You're from India, maybe? Pakistan? Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka, okay. We had a mega city campaign in Colombo, Sri Lanka. And so I've been there many times. But you look like somebody from India, which is the same, you know, basically the same, you know, kind of outward. And I see Chinese. That's not Chinese. Filipino, yeah. And then there's, are you from? Mexico, okay, Mexico. Yeah, they've asked us to do a megacity campaign in Mexico City, by the way. And we're discussing that as well. Who else is from where? Are you from China?
I'm 16, but both my parents are from
Vietnam. Vietnam, okay, yeah. Well,
Colombia.
Colombia, yeah, South America, yeah. We did one in Paraguay. We did one in Cuba as well. Anybody else from any other ethnic group? Finns, I know there are a couple of Finns here. Anyway, the reason why I ask this is because one of the areas of ministry that we have three major ones, but one of them is called megacity media campaigns. You go into a megacity for 30 days working closely with the churches on the ground. Let me take Mumbai for an example because it's kind of like a good one. We went into Mumbai and we were invited to come to do this megacity media saturation campaign. The name of the campaign usually is, in most countries, it's the experience the power to change. And so we went in, 1,700 churches got involved. We trained 14,000 young people for that month. Why? Because we had a call center, which is instrumental to these campaigns. It's key. We had 400 phones that need to be manned 24/7, 400 telephones. So when people start calling and they start requesting a book in the Hindi language, in Marathi, which is the state language, or in English, then people get that book. But for call centers, receive the phone calls and then they deliver. So you have 14,000 volunteers who start go out and deliver these books. When we started that campaign, we had no idea how many people would respond. It's a Hindu nation. It's not like a Christian nation. It's not like a non-religious nation. It's a vehemently religious nation, Hinduism. So when we did the campaign, we came through with 350,000 people who called the telephones in 6 weeks. 350,000 Hindus and many Muslims. Each person had to be met one-on-one. Now you know why you have 14,000 volunteers. It took us 3 years to meet all these people and to assure them that they got the book that they had asked for when they called in. And it was something unbelievable. I mean, the harvest of souls was something unbelievable. We have done these same campaigns in major cities of India, Chennai, Hyderabad, Mumbai, Bangalore, and then Calcutta, Mother Teresa's hometown. And we've also done them in Colombo, in Sri Lanka. And just because you're here, I want to say this, that campaign was actually hugely influential. Today, it would not be possible because of the political situation, but it was a few years ago, maybe was it 3-4 years ago. One of the guys that was in the book, we have the book is, it has 15 transformation stories in every country, in every city. And in Colombo, we also had the same. So one of the guys in the book with the transformation story, including then, that's those same people in the book would have their TV program, half-hour TV show where he or she talks about her faith nationwide. Same thing in radio, billboards. I mean, it's in all the media. Billboards, public transport system, social media, primetime TV, primetime radio, everywhere. And all these people get showcased everywhere. So this one guy was a travel agent. He owned a travel agency. And he said that when his story came out on television and in the book, he said for four weeks after that, he had 200 top CEOs from his city, Colombo, coming to his office and talking to him on spiritual issues, saying, "Hey, we never knew. Why didn't you tell us your story?" One of the CEOs is the CEO of a big Middle Eastern airline. I've been told I can't say the name of it, but it's a big airline. CEO, the big boss, came and says, "I need what you have." I mean, it's just beautiful. And it's just story after story after story. We were in Tanzania. We just finished Tanzania this past winter. Tanzania, Dar es Salaam. We did a megacity campaign there. We had 2,000 churches involved. 140,000 phone calls came, you know, to the call center in the 4-week period. And of course, you know, as you may not know, but Tanzania is about 60% Muslim, and Dar es Salaam is 50%. A lot of Muslims. When those phone calls came in, we got 140,000 phone calls from just across the nation, basically. 70% of those phone calls were from Muslims. How do we know? Because when the people call and they give their name, you see it's an Islamic name. I said to myself, why is it that so many people, so many Muslims called? And then we started to check around. I looked at the transformation stories, and one of the transformation stories was a guy, he was 20 years old, he's a singer, you're the singer, you sang. So he's like about your age, but he was a Muslim. And when he, before he came to Jesus, his mission was to convert, forcefully convert every single Christian in Tanzania to Islam. But he fabulously came to know Jesus, and he was in the book. His story was in the book. He was on TV. He was on radio. And when his story hit the public, the phones rang like crazy. Tens of thousands of Muslims called to find out what in the world is going on. This guy who had a mission to convert everybody else to Islam, he's preaching Jesus. How did that happen? So God chooses people in his wonderful way to become heralds or mediums, preachers of the gospel. In Cuba, I could go on and on, but let me say Cuba, this is also a great story. When we did a megacity campaign media campaign in Cuba, we had a problem. In all these other cities, in 100 cities, we were able to use media. But in Cuba, you can't use TV. In Cuba, you can't use radio. In Cuba, you can't have billboards. There's 7 billboards in Havana, and every one of those has Fidel Castro on it. And you can't tell the government, can we take down your picture or Fidel Castro's picture just for a month? Maybe put our... Can't do that. So we had a problem, but we ordered 150,000 of these fantastically powerful transformation stories. All these transformation stories, by the way, are chosen locally. They're not imported from another country. They're always locally in the churches. They choose the stories because they know who's got the big story. So anyway, so in Cuba, we printed in Brazil, shipped them to Havana Harbor. Big scandal, you know. How did these, you know, what are these books doing here and stuff like that? But God opened a way. Customs, for some miraculous reason, just passed the books through, and they went through. And the churches used these for the next 30 days. People by the families came to know Jesus. And there was even, I'm talking about military officers, I'm talking about police officers, whole families, lots of young people. The young people just took the books and they went out onto the streets and they just shared. We got videos of these guys, these young Cuban Christians going out there with these little books. And they're, first of all, they're talking to these people. And then when they come to a point where they say, hey, you know, there's 15 stories that you got to read. And they get the book. But they pray on the streets with these people. And they make their decisions on the streets. I said, wow. But the big story came. Denai Suarez was a 20-year-old girl. She was a singer. She took part in one of these, the voice programs, these like song contests on TV. Voice, is that familiar? So she was taking part in a big South American, Central American song contest, secular. 27 countries had sent their candidates. Danai Suarez came from Cuba, and she made her way up the ladder, all the way up to the top. And before the last performance, after which she would be crowned, princess or queen, whatever it is, would be. She decided that she would change the lyrics of the song. She was a Christian. So, appearance in English? Her final performance. She rewrites the song's words, and she starts to sing, Jesus Christ is the only hope of the world. And she keeps singing, and she says, Jesus frees people from alcohol, from drugs, restores families. He crushes the power of sin in the lives of people. That's what she sings. 100 million people throughout South America and Central America were watching that particular performance on live TV from that music festival. 100 million people watching. And there was thousands of people in the audience, obviously. And she does this. After she finishes singing, everybody's just bewildered, everybody's silent. But the chairman of the jury, who was supposed to do the awarding and stuff, he gets up in front of the cameras, comes up to Danai Suarez, and he hugs her. And he says, Danai, you are a brave girl. How much our world needs people like you that are willing to stand for the truth and tell us what the truth is. Live TV. And then, he says, we can't give you the crown because you broke the rules. You changed the lyrics. But we've got another little award for you. Was there something you'd like to say, like, after this? I mean, you know, just say something. And so he, I don't know what she did. She, I guess, pulled out a piece of paper or something. But she read from John, in the Gospel of John, where Jesus says, he that doth sin is the slave of sin. But he whom the Son makes free is free indeed. Couldn't believe it. And then we're in Cuba at that time. We're in a pastor's meeting, and somebody rushes in the door and says, guess what happened? And yeah, you didn't see it on TV, you know? And so they're just jubilant, you know, about Danai Suarez, you know, representing Cuba through all of South America, Central America. Never planned to reach, you know, South America or Central America. We were just focusing on Havana. And here's this young lady testifying, witnessing 100 million people. And then he says, somebody said, why did you do this? Tell us, why did you do this? I mean, you could have been, you know, that, blah, blah, blah. And she said, I did it because I knew that this was my moment to shine for Jesus. My moment to shine for Jesus. That's a testimony. God has a plan for everybody's life. He's got a plan for your life. All he needs is willing vessels, willing people saying that, Jesus, yes, I will. I want to fulfill your will. That's all he really needs. All the other stuff he does through you. That's what happened in Danai's life. That's what's happened in every single one of the 100 Megacity Keep media campaigns we've had around the world. It's the same deal, same story over and over again. Willing servants. He does the miracles. He's good at that. He loves it. God loves doing miracles. Believe me. And so that's part of the story. John, you got to get a book to these people. All that stuff. Anyway, I've talked a long time, but if you have a question or something I could try to answer, maybe if you want to ask. We're also on 16 satellites daily to about 100 million people in the Islamic world. We broadcast, we produce the content, and we broadcast the program starting from Morocco, throughout North Africa, throughout the Middle East, like, you know, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, all the way to the Pakistani border. We do it in Arabic, in Farsi, Somali in Africa, and Amharic, and then Sudanese. And I think we're adding Turkish soon. So we actually produce the content with Christian believers throughout the Middle East who come to our studio and produce the programs. Well, you say, okay, fine, okay, 16 satellites daily. Well, that's good. What does it mean? Well, it means that every year, 2.5 million people respond to these programs. Last year, 2.5 million people responded. You say, well, what does that mean? I mean, in response. Well, it means that 2.5 million people wanted to know who Jesus is and why he's different from Muhammad. And they wanted to know, is there anybody that's different from Muhammad? Many of these Islamists, they are fed up with that religion. And they're saying, there's got to be another. There's got to be an alternative. Hatred, killing, slaughter. Come on. I mean, that's not what my life is all about. I'm a Muslim, but it's not my life. And they say, where's the alternative? And then you see these satellite programs. Satellite television is the biggest thing in the Middle East. You have the greatest amount of consumers of satellite TV today on the planet is the Middle East Islamic countries. It's a big deal over there. Here it's not much, but over there it's a big deal. That's why it's so powerful. We have then follow up. How do you follow up 2.5 million people every year? You can't because it's dangerous. You can't. So they do it by social media. There'll be following them up. But you also have clandestine, unofficial counseling like I say points, not centers, but points throughout the Middle East where people are then. When you feel it's safe and when you feel you can, you direct people to that you know, particular group of believers where that person is nurtured. The whole area is dotted with small groups of people that will receive, try to safely receive a Muslim who has said that I want to receive Jesus, or I want to know more about him. It's dangerous. It's dangerous both ways. It's dangerous for the person who says, I want to know more, because if he does become a Christian, he could be killed. And it's dangerous for those who receive that person, because they'll never know. They can never know for sure who that person is that is contacting them. So it's a dicey thing, but the kingdom of God is flourishing. So many people have received Jesus just, you know, in their living room watching satellite TV. And then by social media, of course, it's a bit safer, so we know what's going on. But there are millions of Christians in the Middle East. Millions. Not because of our ministry alone. There's a lot of other guys doing the same, you know, helping. It's a big team effort, but we're part of it there. And so, that kind of stuff. But when I look at you, and I know that I came from this church, my roots are here, and I see you, I say, God can do anything in your lives. You have no idea what God can do in your lives. If you just give him a chance, let him do it. In my life, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, it just was one thing. I just said to God, I said, God, if you have a plan for my life, fine, I'll do it. If you don't have a plan, it's okay. If you don't have a plan, it's okay. I'll just continue with life. I'll still believe in you. I'll still go to church, no problem. But I'll just organize my own life. I'll just, you know, call the shots. But if you have a plan, you get it all. And I will be willing. And that's what God really wants to hear. Bless you guys. Next time, if God allows, maybe we'll have a video that you'll see, actually see what I'm talking about. We've got videos that'll show you. Maybe next time. Bless you.